Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the very first day of February. Terry McAuliffe is with us this hour. He has a fascinating new book, What a Party, My Life Among Democrats, Presidents, Donors, Activists, Alligators. He'll tell you about that and other wild animals. He's the former chair of the Democratic National Committee, has served in many positions in the Clinton White House, is very, very good friends of both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. He headed Hillary Clinton's campaign for the Senate. He is now campaign chair for Senator Hillary Clinton. He talks a lot in the book about the Democrats in the last 8 years, the elections of 2000, the elections of 2004, where the Democrats went wrong. He talks about the life of a guy who's heavily immersed in politics and has a phenomenal amount of energy. And we're going to talk about a number of those issues with Terry McAuliffe this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Terry McAuliffe, thanks so much for being with us.
Kathleen, great to be with you.
So you can be a success in life even if you get kicked out of third grade.
Yeah, one of my lowest moments, the teacher said, I'm not teaching another day if this man's in this class. So I had to carry my desk up the stairs. I went from 3B to 3A.
What were you doing, sir?
Well, I just like to talk, and sometimes I guess I'm just talking too much.
You do like to talk. You've picked exactly the right profession, right?
That's right. I mean, I've been talking my whole life, and you know, it's one of those early lessons I learned as a kid.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Democrats over the past 8 years. What do you think happened? Let's look at the last go-around. Was John Kerry the best candidate for the Democrats to put forward? Was he badly managed here? You write some very interesting things about that campaign that really he should have won.
We should have won that campaign probably by about 10 points.
Wow.
People didn't want to vote for George Bush again. And listen, I say a lot of nice things about John in the book. I sat down with him for hours after. He's quoted in the book, so it's not like I just make these. He's in the book,
right,
responding. He agrees with most of the things that I said. He should have responded to the Swift votes, because what happened is, you know, here's a guy who went to Vietnam, volunteered twice, and against a guy who didn't go, and somehow we lose that argument. The American public is very smart. They say, if you know, you're not fighting to defend yourself, you're sure as heck not going to fight for us. And then, of course, not allowing us to go after George Bush and even talk about him at our Democratic convention, I say, was probably the highest order of political incompetence ever.
Yeah, so why did that happen? It was a logical place to go, to blast the administration. It was logical.
Sure. I mean, this is your convention. This is the only time a campaign,
right,
with 100 million eyeballs are on you, and yeah, you control the debate. Unlike, you know, the presidential debates where you don't get asked the questions, you control it. And there was a theory inside the Kerry campaign, we don't want to be partisan, we just want a positive convention. Well, you're trying to beat an incumbent president while at war, and you got to convince the American public to get him out of office and put your guy in. And if you can't talk about the other guy, it makes it awful difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And case in point, at the New York Republican convention, they used John Kerry's name every 6 seconds, and they destroyed him and went up 13 points in the polls.
Yeah, flip-flop.
Yeah, remember?
Mm-hmm. Sure, I remember.
You know, you had Zell Miller and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Rudy Giuliani and
right,
Barbara.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the Swift vote for a moment, because it was incomprehensible to a lot of people why Kerry didn't respond and how they could even take that particular part of his life. You know, why can't you take Vietnam
right,
service where he wins these medals and, you know, he's a hero and use that against him? But this whole thing, which we talked about recently, and that's using the internet now, which is such a big part of campaigns, stuff can get out there that may be totally wrong. And you find yourself in a position of having to defend against a lie, because journalism has changed and the way we cover campaigns has changed so much.
That's right. Well, as you know, this was a $300,000 buy. It was a small buy on cable. And they figured that, oh, let's not respond. If we respond, we'll make it a bigger issue. But, Kathleen, they were going after his integrity and his patriotism. As I say in the book, I don't care if it was a $10 buy. When they do that to you, you've got to respond. And I was actually in a debate with Mark McKinnon, who was George Bush's ad guy in London 2 years ago, and he said, Terry, we figured the value of that ad was at least $30 million. Because now with 24-hour news and cable and,
right,
as you say, the internet, boom, that ad took off.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a Bush-Cheney ad. This was an outside independent 527. So
mm-hmm,
an ad that probably determined the outcome of the election wasn't even part of either political presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Bill Clinton for a while. You say, this is quite a paragraph here. I like people who are unafraid, resourceful, resilient. I like people who fight to make others' lives better, who don't take themselves too seriously, can make jokes at their own expense. Think big, dream big, believe in friendship and believe in people. This is why my friendship with Bill Clinton has been one of the greatest experiences of my life.
That's right. I consider him one of my closest friends. I mean, what an experience. I'm a kid from Syracuse. Started my first business when I was 14 years old, went on to start a couple dozen companies and got lucky, was successful in business, and then was able to do politics full-time for free. But the experiences I had with Bill Clinton and just what we were able to do as a family on vacations and the way he treats, and Hillary as well, they treat my five children like their own family. Swimming with them. I talk about how my daughter, 5-year-old Sally, is ordering Hillary around the swimming pool playing mermaid, and my son Jack running her over at Camp David in a golf cart. I thought, my goodness, I've just killed the first lady.
Oh, jeez.
And she dusts on me, and there she's rolling on the ground. I'm thinking, oh, my goodness. Talk about a career ender.
Yeah, really?
But she got up, dusted off, and said, now, Jack, did Bill teach you to drive? I thought that was pretty good. But, you know, we were fortunate. We got to go up to Camp David Thanksgivings, and, you know, and the pictures in the book of, you know, him holding my children as babies and growing up. I mean, you know, he's just such a special guy. I say he's like a giant Saint Bernard. He loves people and wants everybody to love him. He's just a good old boy from Arkansas, born on a dirt floor, and rose to become president of the United States, but he never forgot his roots. And he's just a load of fun to be with.
Yeah. What about where the Democratic Party is now? It seems as though, and let's talk about the war for a little while here, because it seems to be the defining issue of our time and may indeed be for the presidential race here. Do you think we got everybody from, you know, Feingold, who's talking about this is it, we're going to introduce it, let's get out of there right now, this thing should be over, to debate about a non-binding resolution? Do the Democrats, Terry, need to be of one voice here? Is that what the American public was asking them in November?
Well, I just got to tell you, Kathleen, that will never happen in our party.
Yeah.
which is part of the diversity of our party, which makes it great. I mean, we're all in agreement today. We've got to change course. Not only the Democrats, let's be honest, many Republicans have joined us. We've got to begin to get the troops home. We've got to put benchmarks in Iraq. We can't keep wasting billions of dollars, and the Maliki government, the Iraqi government, isn't doing anything to protect our soldiers. So we got to send a strong signal and begin to get those troops home. So, and the overarching theory, yeah, we're in agreement. But how you actually do it, is it the Biden plan to split the country up? You know, we differ. But you're never going to get everyone to agree. Listen, my wife and I don't agree all the time. You know, nobody agrees with everybody all the time. But as long as you can move it forward in a general consensus way, that's what you get. 06 was about the American public has said they've had it. They had it with Iraq. They had it with this guy Abramoff, with all these Republican members of Congress going to prison. They had this Mark Foley pedophile. They just washed their hands and said, you know, you have done the least work of any Congress in our history, the shortest number of days. You've done nothing for us. It is time to go. Mm-hmm. Now, Kathleen, they reluctantly gave us the keys to the car. If we can drive this car, I think we have a possible realignment in American politics. And I think Nancy Pelosi is doing a spectacular job and Harry Reid in the Senate. And if we show that we can run in the right direction and actually get results, then it's going to be huge for us going forward.
It is quite something. I was so struck just by the image of Nancy Pelosi at the State of the Union address. I mean, I listened to her carefully, but just to see her there was
right.
So striking, wasn't it, Terry?
It was, and I still love it when she got the gavel and had all those little kids up there surrounding her. I mean, I just that was such a great scene. It's a new day for the Congress. It's a new day for the country. And I've known Nancy probably 26 years. Mm-hmm. I'm in San Francisco today, actually.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, I'm out here doing my book tour, and I just remember fondly all the times I'd spent out here. My second fundraiser as a 22-year-old kid was out here working with Nancy on a huge breakfast with Rosalind Carter, which we sold out. Not only sold out, Kathleen, we took 3 additional rooms at the St. Francis Hotel.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, isn't that something? Tell me how politics got in your blood. Tell me a little bit about your dad.
Yeah, he did it. He was a great guy up in Syracuse. He was the treasurer of the Onondaga County Democratic Party up there in Syracuse. And, you know, he used to raise about, I don't know, maybe $300 a year for the party. But, you know, he always took me down to meetings and rallies. And at a young age, I just started going door to door, getting petitions signed. So my father got it into my blood at a very early age. He was my best friend. He He died on New Year's Eve 2000. Mm. I say he didn't want to go into a new year with a Republican moving back into the White House, but he died drinking a scotch, watching the Philadelphia Eagles football game. Pretty good way to go. And then I talk about how Bill Clinton came up to his funeral. He and Hillary came up in a blinding snowstorm to give the eulogy. They only had 2 weeks left in office. But the great story about, you know, my father always hated dogs, and I always wanted a dog as a kid, but he just hated it. But since the president was coming, we were at the funeral home about to go to the church, and the Secret Service brought the bomb-sniffing dogs in because, of course, the casket would be next to the president. So the dog starts sniffing around the casket and up in the sniffing Jack. So we always got a kick out of it. The last sight on earth for Jack was a big old St. Bernard dog looking down at him. I just thought that's justice.
Oh, Terry, that's quite a story. There's another dog story in the book concerning Barbara Streisand, right?
Yeah, poor Barbara. I mean, we were doing a huge event for President Clinton for his foundation out there during the 2000 convention. And beautiful home in Malibu, just a gorgeous home. And a lot of acreage out there over on the Pacific Ocean. And so I was there. We're getting ready for the president and all the guests to come. And Secret Service came to me and said, Mr. McAuliffe, Ms. Streisand won't let the dogs on the property. And no dogs, no President Clinton, because the bomb-sniffing dogs always have to go before the president to check out the property.
Right.
So I go to see Barbara. I say, Barbara, we got to get the dogs. Dogs got to come in. If they don't, bomb-sniffing dogs don't come in, you know, he can't come. I don't want dogs in my shrubs. I'm blah, blah, blah.
No.
I said, Barbara, listen, I can't cancel this event right now, but the Secret Service won't let him enter the property. I'll walk around with the dogs. So she lets the dogs in. We start walking around and all that. And about an hour later, just before the event starts, and she's out, I'm out by the tent in the backyard, and I hear this scream. This huge property, and she hit her, like, $5,000 Ferragamo shoes. Guess what she stepped in? And she just yelped at me. What are the odds of that having this huge property?
So, too much. That's too much. So do you have a dog now, Terry?
We do. Well, yeah, we've got a great – I've always had dogs, but my first – once I had my own family, but it's actually a very nice story. Dick Gephardt, who was the – who I'm very close to, one Christmas, we had two children at this time, just absolutely believed we should have a dog. He actually drove 4 hours down to West Virginia, secretly bought a golden retriever puppy, kept it in his house for about 4 weeks, gave it a bath every day in his tub, and on a Christmas day, surprised us with a beautiful golden retriever named Bailey, which lived with us for about, died on Christmas Day, about 11 years later. Now we have Finnegan, and now my other, one of my daughters got a little tiny thing called Daisy. So now we actually have two. So five kids, two dogs. It's chaos at the house, but I'm always on the road.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about always being on the road. This job that you have is very, very demanding in terms, I mean, you've been on the road, but you also get phone calls from the president at 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning. Why do you do all of that? What's the goal here?
Yeah, and I get asked that a lot because, when you get in this business and you get in at the level I'm in, you're traveling constantly.
Right.
You're always open to attack, which, you got to have a thick skin to be in this business.
Mm-hmm.
When I was chairman of the party, you'd always have protesters, which I always got a kick out of. I'd always walk over and have my picture taken with them. I mean, you just can't take any of this too seriously. But, Kathleen, I look back, and as I say, a young kid who never even left Syracuse till I was 19 years old, and be successful, got lucky in business. I'm the luckiest guy in the world, so I believe I ought to give back, and I do it through politics because I do believe it matters who the president of the United States is. So that's my passion. As I say, if Gore were in office today, we wouldn't be in Iraq. If Kerry had won, there would be no surge today. So it does matter. I want everyone to have the same opportunities that I had as a kid. I am the luckiest guy in the world, and I just want other people to have the same opportunity. And I just disagree with a lot of the Bush philosophy. Obviously, I think Iraq was the biggest foreign policy blunder ever, but on the domestic agenda, I worked hard, got lucky. I'm in that top 1% in America. I've gotten 5 tax cuts, Kathleen, from the Bush administration. This man has made me hundreds of thousands of dollars just by giving me tax cuts. And if he give the top 1%, and I don't, I'm not into this class warfare stuff at all, but, we buy municipal bonds and we become, coupon clippers.
Right.
I think we ought to help the people in this country who are going to create jobs. Give tax cuts to small business. If you want to hire people, you get tax cuts. Do that for the people who need it, because most Americans outside the top 1%, they've seen health care costs go up, education go up, property taxes. Their disposable income is down.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the 1%, we're doing great.
Yeah.
Why should I get 5 tax cuts and 1.2 million children lose their after-school program? Those are just priorities that are out of whack.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. I was struck that Senator Webb spent a great deal of time, and I thought he was extremely articulate.
Yes.
his comments following the State of the Union. He spent quite a bit of time talking about the fact that, you know, that we don't have a lot of disposable income, that there are a lot of people who are hurting. And it was right on the heels of the president talking about how the economy is growing and we got all these jobs, et cetera. What's the truth here, and how are Democrats going to use this issue, and should they use this issue in a presidential campaign?
Yes, they absolutely should. The pocketbook issues I talk about are critical. I tried to bring them up, but, you know, Iraq overshadowed it. But you ask most people, do they feel better off financially today than they did 6 years ago, and they'll tell you no, of course not. Their disposable income is down. It is a huge issue. And it's this, you've never seen an income disparity as great as we have today. It's never been this great in modern history. The rich have gotten richer, and everybody else has not done as well.
Al Gore, you mentioned him. You think he was the best vice president in history, but you're upset that he didn't have Clinton campaign for him.
Yeah, and I talk about the story. I'm on the golf course with Bill Clinton. You know, he looks at me and says, Terry, what the heck am I doing golfing with you with an election right around the corner? And I said, well, I don't know. But, you know, here we had the greatest economy of all time, peace around the world, and people wondered, you were his vice president, why aren't you campaigning together? Sure, they were mad about impeachment,
right,
but you could have handled that in 2 seconds and said, yeah, horrible mistake. However, look at all the things we accomplished, and that would have ended it.
Yeah.
They're different people, and I just think by not using them created an issue throughout the whole campaign.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting that the American people, as they are, I think, in Iraq, that they were in a completely different place than they cared about the issue. They cared about Clinton and Monica, except that they just didn't think that impeachment should be the punishment for this.
Right. They thought they'd gone too far. People make mistakes.
Right.
And don't forget, Kathleen, we picked up seats in the 98 midterm elections, which was a first. That was historic that we were able to do that.
Yeah. But weren't you upset with him about all of that? I mean, come on.
It created this
distraction.
And I say that in the book.
Yeah.
I was very upset. But, you know, Kathleen, he was my friend.
Right.
And he made a horrible mistake. But, you know, in my religion, you forgive and forget. And he went through a personal hell. I talk all about that in the book, which, you know, I thought in order to be a fair, honest assessment of my time together, I had to.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls. Terry McAuliffe is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. His book is What a Party, My Life Among Democrats, Presidents, Candidates, Donors, Activists, Alligators, and Other Wild Animals. He served in all kinds of positions in the Clinton White House. As you've heard him described, they are very, very good friends. He is now campaign chair for Senator Hillary Clinton. He's on a book tour now talking about the book that he's just been released. So we'll go to you in a minute, okay? I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're wondering what a presidential shower is like, there's a wonderful little story about his being able to take a presidential shower that I think it was installed by Lyndon Johnson. We'll get the I love these little stories. We'll get to that in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Terry McAuliffe is our guest. We're just switching phones here for him. So give us a minute and we'll talk about and we'll take your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, if you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. The book is just, you know, it's really fascinating. He was chair, as you'll remember, of the Democratic National Committee from 2001 to 2005. He raised a ton of money. He's known as a phenomenal fundraiser, and He comments in the book about all kinds of different issues and looks at, you know, his incredible friendship with Bill Clinton and with Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Al Gore. He talks about George Bush. He talks about how campaigns were mismanaged, et cetera. He is now the campaign chair for Senator Hillary Clinton. And we're welcoming phone calls. We start with John from Eagle River. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good, good.
Good.
Terry, two quick questions, one on Gore and one on Kerry.
Okay.
And by the way, I saw you last week on TV. You were terrific.
Thanks.
In an interview.
I was on a lot of shows.
I'll bet you were.
Anyway, you can ask me for as much money as I'm able to give, by the way.
All right. Thank you, John.
Good. Anyway, I read that for Gore, that if he had not gone to court, Florida would have done an automatic recount. He would have been elected.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, I wonder why Kerry never ran on the fact that he had discover the Iran-Contra affair and expose all of that.
Right. One, you're right. We had the right, and I talk about this in the book, we had the right for an automatic recount if the vote was under 1%. You had the option of then just going and asking for a limited recount. We went in and asked for four counties. They were all Democratic counties, which I think, I say in the book, I believe was a mistake. We should have had an automatic statewide recount, because when we picked only four Democratic counties, we never sort of had the public on our side, because it looked like we were trying to cherry-pick counties. We should have done the entire state of Florida, and he'd be in the White House today. I mean, we made some horrible mistakes down there. The butterfly ballot, which, as you know, 100,000 members of the Jewish faith voted for Pat Buchanan, someone who questioned the existence of the Holocaust. Now, unless there's a cult I don't know about, it was a bad vote, and it was the butterfly ballot, which, you know, I kept outside my office my entire tenure as chairman because, listen, I went to law school. I read a lot. It took me 5 minutes to make sure I had actually voted for Al Gore in the 2000 election. So you have some 80-year-old woman with macular degeneration. That was very hard. But, you know, a Democratic county chairman had approved that ballot. That was a mistake. You know, so we should have won Florida, West Virginia. We should have won Tennessee. The stakes were so huge, and there were just mistakes made. In the recount, I also make the point, we just didn't fight hard enough.
Yeah. So who makes the decision, Terry? How much talk is going on about how that recount was conducted? In other words, how was the four Democratic counties the winner?
Well, that was done inside. There were about, from what I know, three or four or five people around the vice president who, you know, were the chief people in charge of making those decisions around. It was not a big open process. And remember Tom DeLace and all these kids down from his office who banged on windows? They shut recount offices down. They fought harder. And Kerry should have made a bigger issue of his Iran-Contra. He, you know, got the BCCI scandal all, but it never got into the campaign. They just tried to run too cute of a campaign, not create any waves, just try to get through because people were unhappy with Bush, and if John could be an acceptable alternative, then he would win. But that's just not how it works. You got to engage in it, and you got to get out there and. They tricked him into that $87 billion question. I mean, that was a young operative from the Bush campaign that was at a rally and kept yelling at John, why'd you vote against our troops? Why'd you vote against our troops? And he looked at him and said, I voted for that $87 billion before I voted against
it. Right.
Well, that was a Republican operative with a video camera. And they knew right then they had that ad.
Yeah.
And to go to your earlier point, Kathleen, with YouTube and everything else you got out there, you got to be very careful. What you say, because everyone's going to see it in seconds.
You're going to be in for a long, interesting run this go around. Anything else, John?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to a Hillary Barack Obama ticket.
That'd be exciting, wouldn't it?
It would be.
That would shake things up.
It'll be a winner for sure.
Yep, good. All right.
Thanks very much for the call. 800-486-8655 is our number. We go to Carl from Portage next. Hi, Carl.
Yeah, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Carl.
Since the year 2000, the campaign of 2000, it's been clear that there is some kind of a force field surrounding this George W. Bush, and he's untouchable. The Democrats are afraid to touch him, 2000, 2004, down to this day. What is the reason why you guys just won't go after
him? I wouldn't put Terry in that category. I think you went after him, Terry, didn't you?
I think, and Carl should read the book, but I was considered the most partisan chairman in American history.
Right.
I mean, I was his biggest critic, but, you know, Carl makes a good point that this guy was in such trouble. On September 10th, 2001, there's no way the guy could win re-election. 9/11 occurs, and the country naturally rallies around their president. And, you know, he went up in the polls, and, you know, he got the bullhorn, and the 02 midterms were all run in the specter of 9/11. Remember, they went after Max Cleland and ran. Here's
yes,
a triple amputee
right,
from
yep.
Vietnam,
yep.
Democratic senator from Georgia. They ran ads, and the senator who ran the ads against him had gotten three or four deferments from Vietnam. And they put pictures of Max up there with Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. Now, Max should have hit back immediately. But, you know, the whole midterms was all about, you know, the war on terror and homeland security, which, as you know, Joe Lieberman had first come up with the idea. Republicans took the idea. Then the whole thing came down to they were going to collapse federal agencies into one. And if you'd work for the federal government, you, of course, would bring your benefits over to the new agency. They said no. You don't get to bring any of your benefits, no matter how long you've worked for the federal government. So the Democrats stood up and fought for that, which was the right thing to do. But because of that, they made us look somehow we were not patriotic and we could not defend America. And they didn't fight back. And then, of course, 04, which I talk about in exhaustive detail in the book, they didn't go after Bush. I mean, I was the one who just... So, Carl, please read the book and get your friends to read it.
Yeah.
But when you talk about that, I couldn't agree with you more. Now, I will tell you, the force field is gone. He's at 28%.
Right.
Everybody beats up on the guy. I mean, he's going to be the worst president in our nation's history. I mean, what this man has done to set back this nation overseas will go on for 50 to 100 years.
Yeah. You were also one of the guys who repeatedly on television and elsewhere brought to the public's attention the National Guard duty service on the part of the president. And that's in the book. Talk about that story. And were you silenced on that? Did somebody say, hey, stop going after him on this?
Well, and I knew what was going to happen. So as soon as it looked like we were going to get a nominee, they knew they couldn't talk about their domestic. It all had to be the war on terror. All had to be patriotism. And we knew that John Kerry had served in Vietnam. So I knew they were going to go after him early on this. And my research director at the Democratic National Committee, Jason Miner, who was there in 2000, had always briefed me and said they let Bush off the hook. The press just didn't go after him on his very confusing National Guard service. If you serve in the National Guard, you're in our military, you serve with distinction. But Bush didn't show up. His commander in Alabama says he never saw him. You know, he gamed the system. He jumped over about 60 people to get into the National Guard because his father was a congressman. And then he abused the system and used it and didn't show up when he should have shown up. So this was all heavily researched. So I was on George Stephanopoulos, and if they and we had it all briefed out, and I briefed the campaigns, that if they were going to go after us, I was going to launch on this. And sure enough, the weekend before, the chairman of the Republican Party went after Kerry and made fun of his military record and his national service.
Yeah.
So I said, if they come after us, a man who with medals all over his chest against a guy who was AWOL in the National Guard, and boy, I tell you, that thing took off.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 months, Bush dropped 15 points in the polls. Finally, we'd gotten his credibility. And to the point that Tim Russert even went in the Oval Office and said, Terry McAuliffe, the chairman of the Democrat, you know, I can guarantee the chairman of the DNC was never quoted in the Oval Office to George Bush before.
Mm.
And he had no answer to the National Guard questions. We had him on the run. And then Kerry's campaign manager called over to my chief of staff and said, tell the chairman, no more talk of AWOL. It's too partisan.
Oh, geez.
And I was muzzled on that.
Yeah.
So, Carl, you're going to cry when you read the book. I apologize. But it's just meant to be instructive. It's not personal.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Steve from Oshkosh next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Mr. McAuliffe.
Hi, Steve.
Could you chime in? I'm wondering why Democrats for so long have had a hard time commanding the language from Republicans. You can start with estate tax, death tax. You can look at surge right now. I don't know why Democrats will honor the term surge. I would call it an accelerated genocide.
Yep.
And when George Bush refers to the Democrat Party, I think somebody should fire back and call it the Republican Party.
That's right.
Or the Fascist Party.
Yeah, I agree. And you're right, and the surge is no surge, first of all. It's going to take 6 months to a year to get these troops and equipment into Iraq. So this idea that these troops, you know, 22,000 all of a sudden are going to be there next weekend, it's crazy. So the one thing I will guarantee you, it will be on the 08 ballot. It's going to go into the election season. It's going to take a while to get these troops in there. But they traditionally, on the social issues, and their mantra is simple. You know what's coming. You know, they're going to raise your taxes. They're going to, you know, they're going to let gay people live next door to you, and they're going to want everybody to have abortions at will. I mean, their message is always the same, and it's so simplistic for them. And we haven't fought back hard enough on these issues. And, you know, they win the social issues because they demonize us and make us look, you know, we're not moral and we're not patriotic. And I do talk about this a lot in the book, that we stand there and take it, and we don't fight back. I mean, I was always vicious when someone came after me. You're no more patriotic than I am. I didn't serve in the military. I was young. My father sure as heck did, and I understand what it is to serve in the military because I listen to my father talk about it every night.
Mm-hmm.
So don't tell me you're more patriotic than I am. It used to drive me crazy. But you make a valid point. I mean, they got the linguistic skills. They got it down to, you know, a couple phrases. And we've got to get ourselves back. If we can't come up with the effective phraseology in 08 after what we've been through with these 8 years of George Bush, then we have to start a new party.
Mm. But they do have this really bad war going on, Terry, that so many people in America are very upset about. I say over and over on this show, it's just increasingly hard to watch news reports of where bombings are taking place and kids are getting killed in schools and markets. And it just seems like it's totally out of control. And I want to go back to this issue with you for a moment. What serves whoever the candidate's going to be for the Democrats best? Should there be congressional investigations at this point of intelligence that we had that wasn't accurate intelligence? Should there be lots of investigations of what's happened with Reconstruction money? Is that over the dam? Or what did we do about it?
And they're all going on now. Let me tell you, you bet. Listen, my main point on the on the Congress the last couple of years is they abdicated their responsibility under the Constitution. Their job is to do oversight. We now know that billions of dollars of your money was wasted, gone. We know that intelligence data was cherry-picked. We know that the certain people, the CIA, who right. said, no, there are no weapons of mass destruction, were muzzled. So we need congressional oversight so these mistakes never happen again. And they are. You look at the list of hearings that are coming up right now, which is spectacular. And this is, everyone said, we don't want you to just come in and investigate. It's not the point. The point is they want oversight. This is your money. These are your sons and daughters who are over there fighting. And you want to make sure that the horrible mistakes that were made over the course of the last 6 years don't happen again. So we've got to have oversight, I believe, Kathleen, on all of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the good news is they're doing it. But this isn't like petty stuff like they did. Remember all the ridiculous things during the Clinton years and that crazy Congressman Burt in his backyard blowing up watermelons or whatever? I mean, those folks were nuts. They would do all these investigations just to bankrupt, and I talk about this in my book, to bankrupt the Democratic Party. They created issues. They wanted to subpoena everybody who worked in the Clinton White House. They wanted to bankrupt these young kids. It was awful.
Yeah.
With no basis of fact. I remind you that Whitewater, which was the beginning of a lot of these, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money, Whitewater was fully investigated by an independent counsel by the name of Robert Fisk. He reported back no issues, no problems, no illegality, nothing with Whitewater. That wasn't good enough for the Republicans and this Reagan judge by the name of Sentell. That's when they brought in Ken Starr. People forget that Whitewater had been fully investigated by an independent counsel and cleared. They started a whole new one, and that led to just hundreds of these investigations. You talked to people in Little Rock, Arkansas. They were terrorized by the FBI. So while you had the FBI chasing, you know, all these ridiculous things down in Arkansas all over the country, we had people taking airplane lessons in this country who were learning how to fly 747s and didn't want to learn how to land.
Mm-hmm.
But the FBI did nothing about it. And I think Louis Freeh was probably the worst FBI director in the history of the FBI.
Mm-hmm. All right, back to Iraq for one more minute, then we'll go back to the phone calls. What do the Democrats need to do? They're going to have a mess on their hands in 2008 should they win the White House here.
Yeah.
Can they be effective in some way in answering the request from the American people? It's more than a request. It's demand, I think, at this point. Please do something about this. Please. We don't want to be embarrassed anymore. We don't want this kind of death. We don't want to put our soldiers in harm's way. We're not sure if our young person is going to be the last person, as Kerry said, to die for a mistake here. They want a change here. They don't, I don't think, want, well, you know, we're going to keep funding the troops. We're going to do something that maybe we'll move them to the edge. They want something. They want a direction.
They want results. That's what I've told the House Senate leader.
Mm-hmm.
People want results.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. This next president, you know, who I hope will be Hillary, but whoever it is on the Democratic side is going to have to once again go in and not only clean up Iraq, but gigantic budget deficits, which Bill Clinton inherited the largest, turned them into surpluses. Bush immediately turned huge surpluses into huge deficits because he gave people like Terry McAuliffe 5 tax cuts. So we got to fix the budget deficit again. But on Iraq, what we need to do, and I can tell you from my personal experience, as I say, I travel the region extensively. I mean, I was recently in Kuwait. They had 10,000 people for several days protesting the United States of America in the streets. That's
really?
Never occurred before. We
really?
Saved that country.
Yeah.
In Egypt, you have the Muslim Brotherhood winning local elections.
Hmm.
In Kuwait, the parliament, the opposition, wanted control of the parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening now is all these other countries over there who we depend on. I mean, Kuwait's the second biggest oil producer for us. All these other countries, their governments are now threatened to be taken over by people hostile to the United States of America. So the whole region is on tinder.
What a mess.
It's a mess. And then you've got Afghanistan, which we pulled our troops out of to go into Iraq. Kabul is now back with the warlords. You now have the Taliban back in Afghanistan, poppy production into its highest level,
mm-hmm.
Iran now with a nuclear program, North Korea now with 9 nuclear weapons. They had none when Bill Clinton left office. You've got Hezbollah firing thousands of rockets into Israel. It's a mess. So the next president, and what the world leaders tell me in the Middle East is, first and foremost, this administration dictates to us. They don't talk to us. They dictate, and we're sick of it. We've got to convene a Middle East summit where they have respect for the President of the United States. We can't do it. It's a political solution we've got to have over there. We can't do it militarily. Had we gone into, if you want to help the Middle East, we should have gone over and built some, you know, water plants and helped them
mm-hmm.
build roads. But we've spent billions and billions of dollars militarily to create a civil war. we could have given every American health care for the next 10 years.
Somebody did some math and called in a few weeks ago, I keep mentioning this, and said that we could have built a $60,000 house for every Iraqi. Isn't that amazing? $60,000 house.
Yeah. And yet, as you know, Kathleen, they still, in most parts of Baghdad, they still don't even have power or water. And you wonder why they're mad at us.
Yeah. Terry McAuliffe is our guest. His book is What a Party, My Life Among Democrats, Presidents, Candidates, Donors, Activists, Alligators, and Other Wild Animals. Just been published by St. Martin's Press. He's on his book tour right now. He's a busy guy. He's also the campaign chair for Senator Hillary Clinton. So more phone calls in a moment. We'll digress a minute and talk about the presidential shower. I mean, why not? Life is full of trivial things as well as huge issues. So we'll go to that in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Terry McAuliffe is our guest. His book, and it's a wonderful read, is What a Party, My Life Among Democrats, Presidents, Candidates, Donors, Activists, Alligators, and Other Wild Animals. All right, so it was Lyndon Johnson who installed this fancy-dancy shower, and you got to take a shower in the presidential shower stall. What a deal.
That's pretty funny. I was out golfing one July 4th weekend. My family was traveling, and the president called and said, Mac, you want to come down and golf? I said, sure. So he and I go out golfing, and it was about 105. It was so hot. So he said, what are you doing? I said, nothing. I said, Dorothy and the kids are going. I said, well, come on to the White House. We'll have dinner with Hillary and watch a movie. I said, great. So we go back to the White House, and the president takes me up into the presidential bedroom shower. Hillary's up there. I say, hi, how are you? So I go in the shower. Pretty funny. The president takes a shower. I mean, this is a little unique situation, as you can imagine.
Yeah, right. Right.
You know, guys in the locker room after golf. No big deal, huh? But he happens to be the president of the United States. So I get in the shower and take my shower, and he's still talking away. You know, I'm saying, gosh, when is he going to get out of here? But you turn on the shower, it's like a it's like a super-duper fire hose. And I'm telling you, I don't know what Lyndon Johnson's thinking. I let out such a yelp. But the best part of the story is, so I had no clothes. So, you know, because they're all sopping wet and all that. So he leaves some clothes out for me. And then he and Hillary go upstairs to get ready for dinner. I say, I'll be right up. But the clothes he left me, Kathleen, were at least three sizes too small.
Oh.
And I know he did it on purpose.
Oh.
So visualize the panic. Here I am in the presidential bedroom in the White House on the second floor.
Oh, geez.
With no clothes to wear. Supposed to go upstairs to have dinner with the president and first lady. And I know he's played this joke on me. He couldn't fit into these shorts. I knew it, or the shirt. So I start rummaging through his drawers. I'm thinking, oh, my, what if they come in and rummaging through the president's drawers? So I finally get some clothes that fit, which most of those in his closet, I want you to know, were the right size. So I go upstairs, and he just sort of gives me that smirk, and I just, you know, that's how he is, though. It was a pretty funny story.
Oh, it's a great story. Glenn is next from Spooner. Hi, Glenn.
Good morning.
Hi.
Kathleen,
morning.
Enjoy your show. Never had a chance to tell you that.
Thank you.
I'm a first-time caller.
Oh, thanks for calling.
And I have a question that goes back. I mean, this is kind of like a downtown quarterback on Saturday morning, you know. But in 2004, I think of the Harkin oil tactics that President Bush used, and I was just waiting for the Democrats to slam him on that. And the Air National Guard records somehow mysteriously lost, and oh, they're going to really slam him on this one. And meanwhile, the Swift Boat boys crucify Kerry on very shaky information, and that's the one that gets all the ink. I'm wondering if there was some reason for that, or I've been thinking about it a long time since 2004, and what happened?
Well, all I can say, sir, is if you go Google Terry McAuliffe and Harkin or the National Guard in records, I'll come up 10,000 times. I mean, I was out early on the Harkin Energy deal. I'd always wanted to know who they sold the stock, who George Bush sold his stock to. And to this day, we don't know because, as you know, in the Harkin Energy deal, he was the chairman of the audit committee. He sold his stock before a report came out a month later, which had very damaging financial news for the company. And here he was, knowing it, and sold his stock. If that had been you or I, the SEC, we would have been put in Alcatraz for 200 years. But no. His father was the president of the United States, so that wasn't going to happen. But he sold the stock to somebody at an inflated price. And to this day, I used to walk into my research department, the DNC, 60 very young, talented killers in there, and I'd offer them, you know, a $1,000 prize if they could ever find out who he sold his Harkin energy stock. But we could never get it. It was private information. I never got it. But I was always out on that. And then, of course, you know, I led the fight on the National Guard. But you make a very valid point. Somehow, mysteriously, and they talked that it was that Joe Albaugh, one of his top campaign operatives, had gone over to the national headquarters for the National Guard and gotten all his documents. And that's why, you know, they did a thorough, what we call, sweep and clean before he announced for president to go try and find all these things that were out there that could come back and be damaging to the president.
What do you think would have happened, Terry, if the Dan Rather story had been seamless?
Yeah, what happened, I mean, it was bizarre because here was a legitimate story that then when the CBS thing happened, it really took the air out of the whole story. Mm-hmm. It really was unfortunate because it made it look like it was this big conspiracy and some person, I mean, they got bamboozled by some, you know, operative. Who knows if Karl Rove set him up? I mean, we'll never know the story. Mm-hmm. But had the Dan Rather story not come out and been totally discredited, you know, that issue still would have been alive today. But I also, and I don't want to be too tough on Kerry, I just lay these things out so people understand, but he did get 9 million more votes than any Democrat ever. If he'd shifted 60,000 votes in Ohio, he'd be president today. And I can't go on without saying that, you know, Osama bin Laden, as you know, did a video, what was it, 6 days before the election, which was very damaging. Had Osama bin Laden not done that video, John would definitely be in the White House today. I mean, if you remember, he talked about red states, blue states. I mean, he helped Bush. There was no question about it when that video came out, and we had a feeling that was going to happen. And sure enough, there he was on all of our television screens, frightening. And who he really frightened was the swing voters who had moved over to us. But as soon as they saw Osama on our TVs, boom, they went back because they thought Bush would keep them safer because we had not laid that foundation after the Swift votes.
Yeah, but the Bush administration didn't get him. There he was out there making a video, right?
Could you imagine if Bill Clinton was president and to this day, 6 years, 7 years into his administration, and he hadn't gotten... Can you just imagine? They would have a clock on the front of the Republican National Headquarters, day whatever, where's Osama?
Mm-hmm. I think you're probably right. Did you have anything else, Glenn?
Just thinking about what you were saying about the Middle East and all of the problems we're in. My son has traveled extensively around the world, and he's saying there is such anti-American sentiment out there, it's scary. And
yeah,
to think that one person can cause all of that, that's even scarier.
Yeah, that's right. So, and you go over there and you walk down the streets and people yell stuff at you. That never happened to me before. They just hate us, and it's really unfortunate. You know, there are a billion Muslims out there who have, you know, turned against America, all because of this, you know. And we don't understand what's being shown. We don't see hardly any of what goes on the Iraqi civilian side. But in the Middle East, you see that. You know, every night, all these children being carried out who have been killed in bombings and all that. You know, it's what happens in a war. But over there, as you can imagine, it's not. It's totally different what they show over there on Al Jazeera and these other channels.
Yeah. Thanks, Carl, so much for being a caller. Call again, please. You're always welcome. Getting back to Kerry for a moment, you talk about the bin Laden tape, but you also criticize Kerry that he left, what was it, $15 million in the bank after the election? I mean, he could. Why did he do that?
Kathleen, there's never been a good explanation why you would. People don't give you money to have it sit in a bank account.
Yeah.
They want it spent on an election. As I say, if we had shifted 60,000 votes, if we had just shifted those 60,000 votes in Ohio, it'd be present. You could have shifted those. I mean, we didn't have black radio running in Cleveland. I mean, there's many things we could have done.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I'm baffled. Mm-hmm. I have no idea why they left that money sitting in the bank account.
Yeah. We have a couple lines open now. If you've been wanting to join us, our lines have been crowded, so take this opportunity. Terry McAuliffe is our guest. His book is What a Party, My Life Among Democrats, Presidents, Donors, Activists, Alligators, and Other Wild Animals. Former chair of the Democratic National Committee, served in all kinds of positions in the Clinton White House, and is a very good friend of both Clinton's Bill and Hillary, and he is now the campaign chair for Senator Hillary Clinton. 800-486-8655 is the number. Ron from Grafton is our next caller. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. I have a question for Mr. McAuliffe, or if you could say a suggestion anyway.
Sure.
I think if Hillary's going to become president, she's got to do something to soften her image.
That's right.
Because perception is everything in this game.
That's right. No, listen, you make a very valid point. Everybody knows she's tough, she's strong, she's got great leadership qualities, and that's why I hope everybody buys the book and reads it, because you'll see the softer side of Hillary. But let's be honest, there's been millions of dollars spent to demonize this woman, and we have to make sure that people get to know her the way I do. And that's, you're exactly right, I think our launch in Iowa could not have gone off any better. She's actually telling jokes. I don't know if she's goofing on her husband or whatever, but she's actually having a good time doing it. And I agree 100%. If we need to get people to understand her, to like her. I call it the beer test. Would you rather have a beer And, you know, unfortunately, as I said earlier, 65% of people said they'd rather have a beer with Kerry than with Bush than Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to get everybody to like her, and that's what we have to do to know her, really. Because, let's be honest, she is, you know, Hillary's one of those people in the world who, you know, only needs a first name. And she is defined by a lot of people. And we've just got to get the truth out to so many people about her and get to know her. And that's why she's doing these conversations on the web. She's trying to do small meetings in Iowa, but, you know, it's hard when you have Secret Service. You've got 100, you know, national reporters with cameras.
Right.
It's a challenge for us, but, you know, you're exactly right. We check that box and get people to know where they're going to vote for her, and that's what we have to do. I mean, you hit it right on.
What about the darn thing that this is going on and on and on, Terry? I can't imagine how many conversations we're going to have about this presidential race. We've already had a ton of them, and it's so far away.
Right.
My golly, it's too long, don't you think?
I do, and here's what's happened, though, is these states have now, Kathleen, moved up. California has announced they're moving up to February 5th of 2008.
Mm.
Florida is announcing they're moving to January 29th. So I hate to tell you this. We're going to have a nominee a year from today.
Mm.
And that's why people had to start their campaigns early.
Yeah.
And they got to fix the calendar because I just read the other day that if Florida moves up, New Hampshire says they're moving into December. So, you know, you're going to be out Christmas shopping and people are going to be putting bumper stickers in your bags.
I mean, oh, my gosh.
It is early. And that means we have a 10-month general election, which, boy, that's a long time.
Yeah, it is a long time.
Yeah, it is.
The other thing that's of concern to people is the amount of money involved in this. It's going to be huge. It's going to be the most costly ever, won't it?
Oh, by far, yeah. Oh,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the reason so many are in this time is this is the first time since 1952 that we don't have an incumbent president or vice president on either party.
Mm-hmm.
So it's wide open. And last time it probably cost us between the party and the Kerry campaign about $1 billion. And it'll be north of that this time.
Yeah. Let me ask this question. You know, it's one of those dinner party conversations.
Yeah.
But this idea of you're obviously a guy who's studied presidents. Are there a couple presidents or one president who you just read everything you can get your hands on about this person because you find him so fascinating, such a wonderful person, so smart, et cetera?
Yeah, for me, it'd be FDR.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You look at how he got us out of the Depression, World War II. I mean, you know, for me, I I've read a lot on Lincoln. I think Lincoln and FDR I've probably read the most on of our two presidents.
Uh-huh. Thanks.
How about you?
Oh, it's Lincoln.
Yep.
I'm from Illinois.
Yep.
You know, it's Lincoln. I just find him a wonderful writer. What a time to become president. Can you imagine walking
right
into the office at that time?
Right. Can you imagine? Right.
Wow. He was, yeah, I love Lincoln.
And you should know there's a great book which I just read by a guy named Tom Wheeler who wrote, it's fascinating. This was the first time a president actually used the telegraph, and it was Abraham Lincoln. He found all the old telegraph communications that he relayed back and forth to his generals.
Oh.
And the book just came out. I just read it the other day. It's some Wired or something, but it's by a guy by the name of Wheeler. It was fascinating about, you know, the inner thoughts of Abraham Lincoln and how he was conducting the Civil War and his communications with his generals. Fascinating.
Ooh, interesting. Might be a good show for Lincoln's birthday.
Right.
Thanks for the programming suggestion.
There you go.
Yeah,
he lives in Washington, D.C. Tom Wheeler.
All right. Shauna from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I want to know why John Kerry did not talk about Guantanamo Bay and about Abu Ghraib. And I want to know what Hillary Clinton is going to do to get those people out after 5 years of being in there.
Yeah, I mean, the Abu Ghraib scandal came up in the campaign, and it was talked about, I got to tell you, pretty extensively, and that really, really hurt Bush. I mean, his numbers really started to decline around the Abu Ghraib scandal, and then, as I say, with the Swift boats and all that stuff, that's how they sort of diverted it away from that, you know, onto John's character. And listen, when Hillary's president, we got a long way to go before I'm saying Hillary's president. We got to go through a primary and a general
election.
We got
some work to do, right.
You know, so we got a lot of work ahead of us. But
Listen,
obviously human rights are going to be a top concern for Hillary. But I'm going to let her talk about that through the course of the campaign. But the Abu Ghraib was very damaging to George Bush. Those pictures and the stories that ultimately came out were very damning for George Bush. And the whole issue went into the whole idea of this eavesdropping, which, you know, they always, you know, to give the Congress the authority to go in and wiretap Americans and others without getting a warrant. And anytime any of us question that, they used to say, well, you know, you want terrorists to be able to call into it. I mean, it was such a joke. All we were saying is, and if it was an emergency situation, you had 72 hours to go get the warrant after you did the wiretapping. But you shouldn't let your government have the ability to go wiretap you without some judicial body having some type of oversight. Mm. But if you remember that whole debate we went through, it was somehow we were being unpatriotic again. And you're going to let terrorists call. The bottom line is, if you needed to intercept a call, do it. It's 72 hours to go to the court, so it's no big deal. Bill Clinton did it many times when he was president of the United States. They intercepted calls and then went to the court later. It's no big deal. But the idea that you're going to give George Bush and his cronies the authority to go wiretap Americans without any judicial oversight, I mean, people fought and died, you know, getting the Bill of Rights and our Constitution going. I'm sorry. We're not going to allow that.
Shauna, thanks for the call. Terry McAuliffe, what a lovely hour. Thanks so much for being
with us.
Well,
thank you, Kathleen. It was great being with you.
Thanks. Terry McAuliffe, the book is What a Party, My Life Among Democrats, Presidents, Donors, Activists, Alligator. Oh, we never got to the alligator story. Sorry. And other wild animals. He is the former chair of the Democratic National Committee. Very good friends with the Clintons and now campaign chair for Senator Hillary Clinton. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to John Treader for on-air production. This show repeats at 10 o'clock tonight. And that's about it for today. Thanks for listening on the Ideas Network.